for one moment. The Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson is going to conduct your hearing, so if you could just hold on, we will be here from Mr. Johnson just very shortly, sir.
Thank you.
Over from the county fence office, you want to come up? You can come up and have a seat there. And we also have, is it Michael Pitten?
Yes.
Are you here, sir? Okay, you could go ahead. You go ahead and have a seat there. Are you the victims?
Yes.
Okay.
And there should be one victim up here on the telephone, please.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson, I don't think I've got a good deal.
Mr. Kelly, if you could just hold on one moment, sir, we need to make one phone call. This is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. Understand you wanted to participate telephonically in the hearing for Mr. Kelly Hamilton?
Yeah.
Okay. We're getting ready to start that hearing. If you would just hold on, and we'll get back with you at the appropriate time as we are conducting the hearing, okay?
Okay.
Mr. Hamilton, are you on the phone? Mr. Hamilton?
Yes.
You still okay? Ms. Neiman, are you still on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Kelly. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I want to introduce you to the board members that are going to be conducting your hearing this morning, okay? Mr. Kelly, are you still there?
I just barely can't hear you.
Okay, is that any better, sir?
Not really. It sounds like you're in a tunnel somewhere or something.
So, Mr. Hamilton, is there a volume or something on the phone where you're at, sir?
No, sir.
Okay, but are you able to hear me and understand me?
Can you hear Mr. Johnson? Can you hear Mr. Johnson, sir?
I can hear you fine. I can't hardly hear him at all.
Let me pass this over to him.
How is it, sir?
Better.
Okay, so you're going before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I want to introduce you to the board members that are going to be conducting your hearing this morning. You have the Honorable Luis Quinones, the Honorable David Moore, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse, and sir, my name is Michael Johnson. I'm going to be your hearing lead this morning, okay?
That just phone's messing up again. I didn't hear nothing you said. I had a bunch of mumbling.
All right, Mr. Hampton, is that any better or is it still on there?
It's still best up, I can't. I just barely can't hear you.
You want to come over here, Mr. Johnson, we'll do it from here.
Okay. Hold on, Ms. Hamilton.
Okay.
To the board members that are going to be conducting your hearing this morning, okay?
Okay, sir.
You have the Honorable Luis Quinones, the Honorable David Neal, the Honorable Gail Rittenhouse, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chair, and sir, my name is Michael Johnson. I'm going to be acting as your hearing lead this morning, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I'm going to go with some information while you get ready to do your hearing this morning. Also, I want to inform you that we do have some the county attorney representative here, as well as we have victim witness advocate that's on the phone, as well as one that is here today that is also going to be involved in the hearing. You're appearing before this board for an absolute discharge, home arrest, or regular parole. Is that your understanding, sir?
Yes, sir.
All righty. You're currently serving a lifetime sentence for first-degree murder. Your sentence began in June of 82. You became parole eligible in June of 07. Is that your understanding, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. According to your institutional progress report, sir, it says that your plans are to reside with your brother, Mr. Danny Hamilton, at 302 here and in Lumberton, North Carolina. Is that still your plan, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me ask you a question on that, sir. Have you, you know, if you were given home arrest, do you have any relatives or anyone here in the city of Phoenix?
I have absolutely nobody outside the state of North Carolina, sir.
Okay.
And I never have visited or anybody from family in 37 years because they live so far away.
Okay, so I see that you have taken some programming that since you've been incarcerated, sir. Tell me about some of the most recent programming that you have.
Well, I've taken all the programs that I'm allowed to take in DOC. I have a letter, there should be a letter in my parole packet from Mr. Lean, where we discuss this with the past parole boards. I was completely stopped from taking programs because I've taken so many. I've taken the substance abuse. I was for many sessions. I took the CIR program, the Community and Recovery program, the Transition to Moral Pre-Release program, which was a year. The CIR program was a year and a half. I've taken the Victims Impact program, where I learned how my crimes and my actions affect the people on the streets, not only individuals, but as a community and as a whole. That's something I didn't understand before when I committed this crime. I had never experienced a situation where loss was involved and responsibility behind it and so forth. And through that program and through the loss of one of my sons and an uncle that I was very close to, I have learned the impact of the crimes on victims in the loss of human life, the loss, and how it affects individuals. And I have acquired the ability to have empathy for people with loss through crimes of different types and through crimes of this nature, through my own losses.
Okay, and according to your institutional progress report, it looks like you haven't had any disciplinary tickets since 2003?
Yes, sir, I've only had two major tickets, two minor tickets in 37 years of it convicted, so none of them treaty acts of violence.
And you have had your first, looks like your first parole hearing was in 07. Looks like you have appeared before this board approximately 22 times, and during those times your hearings were denied. Is that your understanding?
Yes, sir. Well, actually, it was 24 with only one parole board hearing. I waived one parole board hearing, and this would be my 24th one.
Okay. According to court documents that we have, sir, that you were originally charged with first-degree murder, kidnapping, and armed robbery. You entered into a after plea of guilty for the first-degree murder charge in exchange for the state's promise to not seek the death penalty and drop the kidnapping and armed robbery. Is that your understanding, sir?
Along with other things, but the death penalty was actually not even really discussed. It was. The prosecution came at me with the plea agreement only 60 days after coming out here from North Carolina, and they offered me the plea agreement. And because I went through my attorney, I was trying to get my attorney to avoid a trial and put the family through the unnecessary involvement in having a trial and all that. I had to plead guilty to an Alford plea, and with my younger brother being involved in it as well. I basically raised him. My father were separated when we were real young, and I felt responsible, and I trying to protect him because he was involved in it and took the blame, the majority of the blame on myself and all because I was the oldest. I was trying to avoid everybody a whole lot of trouble, a whole lot of aggravation, a whole lot of pain and suffering having to go through a long drawn-out trial and so forth.
Okay.
But we can get it through my attorney.
So this was an incident that occurred back in March of 1982, sir.
Yes.
Where you and your brother were hitchhiking, the victim offered you a ride. You guys were given a ride, said that there was an altercation, became involved in an altercation, and then the victim was stabbed several times and then left out in the desert area of rural Maricopa County. It was later discovered by a biology student from the state of California, approximately 15 days after it happened. Is that about what happened? What was going on during that period of time, sir?
That's exactly what happened. My brother and I were out in San Diego. We went out there to see about jobs. We were born and raised in the country on a farm and never experienced a whole lot outside North Carolina. I was 30 years old, or 29 years old at the time, but I was still basically a juvenile-minded individual. I'd never really experienced a whole lot of things outside of the hometown, little town we were born and raised in, and I was just overwhelmed with everything. We got on the drugs, we got into drugs, and we were drinking, doing drugs and all that. Our car broke down in San Diego, so after we were out there about a month, we couldn't find any jobs or anything, so we were headed back to North Carolina. We figured we'd just hitchhike. Mr. Fritchie picked us up, and the robbery for his van and stuff came up out of that, and I was the one driving. I was the only one that had driver's license. After my brother took custody of him and put him in the back, was sitting there watching him and controlling him, and none of this was premeditated. We didn't talk about it or anything. I didn't even know my brother was planning on doing any of this until it was already in the process. But that's neither here nor there because I was the oldest. I take blame for it. I should have stopped it. And we ended up taking Mr. Fritz's life for his property. And there's no excuse for it. There's no way of getting around. There's no way of trying to share a code or anything. I feel absolute total remorse for the family's loss. I took the blame for it. I feel, like I said, I've learned to through my own losses and so forth with my son and my uncles, that I have empathy for their feelings and stuff, and there's no way I could have any more remorse for the victim's family than what I have. It just was totally unnecessary. It's no excuse for it. I'm not trying to excuse any of it.
Okay, so were you on parole or probation at the time that this occurred?
Yes, sir, I was.
And what were you on?
Those that that time was some bad checks and stuff. Now, probation violation, I think the probation violation was in that too. It was so many years ago, I don't really remember. It was like 37 years ago, and there's a lot of that back then. I don't really remember exactly what all the paperwork was.
Okay. You called back in 75, you were also on probation for assaulting a police officer, personal property.
Damage to personal property, the assault on a police officer was dismissed. That was during, right after an accident. I'd been in a car accident, and I had over 18 and 3/4 inches of cracks in my skull. I threw it out the car in the middle of the highway, and I was in the hospital. Doctor didn't let me out of the hospital too soon, but they had me on some medication to cause pressure to build up my head, and to this day, I don't remember doing what that. And that's the reason why the court dismissed the charge, those charges, because I ended up being put back after they said that happened at the house. They put me back in the hospital, kept me in the hospital another 2 weeks. And most of that time, I was unconscious through getting the pressure down in my head. It's still on the files and all of that. I'm not trying to excuse any of it. They said it happened, it happened. I take blame for it.
So, sir, I also see that in your file there, as you said earlier, numerous programs that you have taken, but I also see some letters in here from Halfway Houses. One of them is Reborn Assistance Association, as well as Traditions, Transitional Living. Have you still been in contact with those two? One of them was in 17, the other one was in May of...
They were approved. They are still approved. The transition is still approved. But the thing is they told me through my counselor and through other people that they are required to have like $1,100 up front before we can... for lifers are moved in, and I don't have that kind of money. And the reason why I had to halfway out is that my intention was always to go back to North Carolina where my family was at, because that's where I have the best chance. I got support back there, community support, I got jobs, I got a place to stay and all that. I'm 67, I'll be 67 years old in 10 more days. And I need my Social Security stuff set up because I'm disabled. But I was trying to put in for halfway out there because past committees, back when Mr. Belcher and them were running the committees and stuff, they told me it would probably be, tried through them, would probably be easier for me to get a halfway house out here and be paroled out here and not go back to North Carolina for a while. But I can't afford the $1,100 up front like that. I can't do it. And that's the reason why I'm trying to parole back to my family. And like I said, that's where I got my support. That's where everybody's at and my family and all.
So have you tried anything to get an interstate compact, sir?
I've got the money on my books. I filled out the interstate compact information and application, but my counselor is holding that, and money's on my books to pay for it. But they will not process the paperwork until they have to have a, before they can even process the paperwork, they have to have a release date for the other state before they can even process the paperwork, according to my counselor.
All right. Well, so let me see if the board has any additional questions for you. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Hamilton, what family do you have in North Carolina?
I have Danny Hamilton, who's my brother, his wife, and two kids. Well, the kids are grown now. I have three kids of my own that live there. I have 11 grandkids. I'm the oldest surviving member of my family. I have several cousins, I have two stepbrothers back there, and I have the community church that my brother's been a member of for the last 40-some years that he is involved in, and the church behind me. They're the ones that's actually offering me a part-time job to go along with my Social Security and to help me with my Social Security.
And where is your brother who was your co-defendant in this case? Is he back there too?
He's back there, but he lives about 30 miles from there.
Oh, okay. So he's not right there in that same town where you're going to go?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Hamilton?
Yes, sir.
I know that you have not made excuses, but there are some notes in the file about drug use at the time of the crime.
Yes, sir.
And again, what sort of drugs were you into at that time?
At that time, I was using a lot of acid, LSD, and marijuana, and I was on a lot of Dilaudids and Valium for my back. I had that back surgery, and I was taking a lot of that, but I was overdoing it, and I was addicted to it. That's what got me started on all the other drugs, with the addiction to the Darbons, the Valium, and the Dilaudids back when I had my back surgery. I overdone it and got tubes hooked on them, and then it just got out of hand from that. I haven't been on drugs out here at all. I got off of them through the drug program and stuff out here. I had one dirty UA back in 1990 for one little small joint that I smoked, and I've been in these programs. Like I said, the CIR program and the transition program, we were required to give a UA once a month at random times every month, and I've never had a dirty UA. I've never had a tick before or even been suspected of any type of drug use. I got away from all that.
Okay, let me follow up with a question, and that is, in your mind, how do you account for having arrived at such a violent act? It makes no sense to me.
All I can tell you, sir, is it just happened. I don't know. We never planned anything like that. We never discussed it. And my brother grabbed Mr. Pritchy when we got stopped to get out of the van. He grabbed him, pulled him into the back. I was on one of the driver's lights, so I was driving. I didn't know what my brother was doing. And then when we stopped off the interstate. We were about probably 50 yards off the interstate at somewhere around Gila Bend, I think, is where it was at. And they got out the side door, and by the time I got around the front of the van, we were getting stopped to relieve ourselves and to take a break. Him and Mr. Pritchy were already tussling, and I honestly, sir, I can't make any excuses for it. I can't try to explain it other than I seen them tussling. I had my knife in my hand, and the next thing I know, I was right in the middle of it, stabbing him as well. And like I said, I'm the oldest. I take full blame for the whole thing. I should have stopped it. I should have known better. I'm not trying to make no excuse. I'm not trying to say it was the drugs. It just happened. It was cruel. It was hideous. It was non-explainable, but unnecessary. And I wish to God I could change it. I don't come to these parole boards looking to get parole. I hope I get a parole, but I don't expect it because of the volume of violence involved in it and because of what I've done. I can't say any more than that.
Thank you for
I'm
your,
sorry.
Thank you for your response, Mr. Hamilton. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Okay. All right. Okay, Mr. Hamilton, I do see that you do have support letters from your family that's actually included, one of which, when I had read in there previously, stated that they were in support of you, but you didn't want your family that much involved in it.
I didn't hear the last part of that, sir.
I had I do see that you have several letters of support from your family that's in your file.
Yes, sir.
And one letter, I believe it might have been a half-brother, who said that basically that they would do anything they can to help you, but you had said that you didn't want them to get too involved.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to get too involved because they don't have the money to come all the way out here and be involved in the parole board hearings and all of that stuff. That was the involvement I was talking about.
Okay.
They're going to help me back there with whatever they can help me with. I've got a place to stay. I've got income that's going to subsidize my Social Security. I'm in a veterans pod here at Red Rock because I'm a veteran, and my disability with my back issue and stuff, I may be able to draw some veterans disability through that. So I'm in a situation, if I can get parole back there, if I make parole, where I can do good. I can be in a situation through the church where I can try to make some kind of amends to the community and maybe do something to, I don't know, just help with some of the wrong I've done over the years.
Okay, Mr. Hamilton, what I'm going to do at this time is I'm going to go to the county attorney who is here, as well as some of the victims who are here to get their testimony at this time. I'm going to go to, first of all, I want to make sure I have this right because I just moved my desk, to Mrs. Valenzuela, who is representing the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. And do you want to go first, or how do you want to proceed? And I know we have someone on the phone, and we also have someone here. Are they going to be speaking, or how's it going to work?
Mr. Johnson, I would ask that the victim next of kin, the representative that's on the phone, and the one that's here speak first.
Okay.
In order to not be as repetitive, I
okay.
will repeat the same facts that they give to you, and I know that in the past, Ms. Neiman has provided facts during her statement, so in case she does, then I won't be repeating the same thing that she's already told you.
Okay. Okay, so Mr. Pitchy, you want to come up, sir? Sir, if you would just come up to the mic, state your full name, and then go ahead and present the information to the board.
My name is Michael Pitchy. My brother had just got out of the Navy. He was getting ready to head home, and he was going to stop to see his father. But he seen two guys that needed help. The type of person that he was, he's going to help somebody. So he decided to help give them a ride. And he let them know that he would only be able to go as far as El Centro because he was going to visit his father. So he gets them in there, and they go down. And when these two were told that their ride was done, they jumped my brother. They tied him up, put him in the back of his van, and then headed out. And when they got to Gila Bend, they decided to get rid of him. Now, I don't know if it was premeditated or not. it really doesn't matter. He was trying to help somebody. And when he gets out of it, it's his own death. He didn't deserve it. It's been 36 years. And it still hurts to know what had happened to him. I've been coming to these hearings since 2005, every 6 months, starting with his younger brother. And it never gets easier. He's gone to classes. He knows how the families feel. No, we don't. There's no way. I've lost other family members. But this one hurts the worst. I have to relive it twice a year. And every time, it always seems like the stories change. Whether it was his brother's story changing every parole hearing, his story changing. Say my brother did drugs with him. Oh, it was my younger brother. If it was his younger brother that instigated everything, well, his younger brother's out. He should get in prison. Still. I was able to help keep him in to the max of his term. It's just not right. He needs to stay in prison. Thank you.
Thank you. So let me see if the board has any questions. Mr. Pitsy, thank you. Okay, I am going to go to Ms. Neiman that's on the phone. Ms. Neiman, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, if you would just state your full name at this time, go ahead and present any information you'd like to present to the board.
Okay, my name is Linda Pitching Newman. Jerry was my brother, and we're 2 years apart, me and Jerry were. I have a lot to say, so just deal with me. And it's written down because I can't word it because I break down. You don't get used to doing this. I don't know how many times we've done this, but it does bother me, so I have to read.
Okay.
This nightmare started when my brother pulled over on a San Diego bypass, probably after getting gas to offer Kelly and Willie a ride, who were hitchhiking. Jerry had recently been discharged from the Navy and was on his way home to Nebraska, but made plans to stop over in El Centro to see his father, who he had only seen twice in his life. I know my brother would have felt sorry for the hitchhiker since he had a vehicle and they did not. This was my brother's first vehicle. He had only owned the van less than a month, and he was very proud of it. The 3 years he spent in the Navy was overseas. When he was 17, he left home. I do remember my gut feeling when he said he was going to drive home. I wasn't comfortable with it because I doubted my brother's naive nature. I worried about the drive. My brother was such a good kid. He never gave my mom any problems. He was an introvert, meaning he did not do much or experience a lot of the outside world before he left to go in the Navy. He was a kid who pretty much stayed around the house doing his own hobbies, motorcycle, bikes, and fishing and camping. He never partied or used drugs. He was a father figure for his 2 younger brothers and spent a lot of time with them rather than going out on the weekends with friends. I know Jerry felt as if he was helping Kelly and Willie out by giving them a ride, and would have not said no even if they were actually the ones who approached Jerry for the ride. Jerry had everything he owned in that van, a motorcycle, electric guitar, which he learned how to play on the USS Midway. He bought it in Japan, military clothing, military papers. So there really was no room for a person to sit in the back. It had bucket seats. So when my brother pulled over, in El Central to let Kelly and Willie out, which Kelly had been sitting directly behind my brother in the back, and Willie was sitting in the passenger seat. I believe Willie pulled the knife out, then Kelly jumped my brother from behind, putting the knife through my brother's throat. I do believe if my brother struggled, it was all in a panic mode, or trying to push away the knife and possibly trying to reach for the van door. You know, my brother did receive two stabs to his upper back sometime during this murder. And the autopsy report did say the victim had defensive cuts to his fingers. Jerry also may have been stabbed once somewhere around the stomach, but was still alive, but bleeding internally. And not all the stabs penetrated organs. Also, if there was such a fight or a struggle in the van like Kelly said, why did my brother's glasses end up next to his body? The detective said that they appeared to have been stepped on because one lens was out, pushed through the frame. Kelly was the one who pulled my brother to the back of that van and tied up his hands. Really tied Jerry's feet. My brother pleaded, "Why are you doing this, man? Over and over. Take my van and stuff. I won't tell anyone. Just don't hurt me." Jerry also complained that the cords were hurt in his wrist and asked Willie if he would loosen them up. But Kelly slammed on the brakes and yelled out for Willie not to touch them. When my brother pleaded that he would not say anything if they would let him go, Kelly's response was, "I already put the knife to his throat and I told him I'd kill him, so there's no turning back." Willie stated that the dude just knew Kelly was going to kill him. He just could tell. When Willie was asked if my brother put up a fight, Willie said no, and that he could not understand why not. He said, "I believe Kelly scared the hell out of that dude when he put that knife to his throat." Willie also commented that he thought my brother was a good, nice dude, and was only trying to help them out, but Kelly just wanted to F him up. Kelly had told the investigators that during the ride out to the desert, he took a hit of acid, but Willie said they had no drugs. Kelly drove that van approximately a half a mile into the desert, stopped, went into the back of the van, and untied my brother's feet. Kelly then walked him away from the van with my brother's hands still tied behind his back. I know they had my brother believing they were just going to tie him to a tree or something, but Kelly knew he was going to kill him. Kelly just found stabbing may have been as much as three times. I do believe Willie also stabbed at some point. After my brother fell to the ground, he was kicked over a hill, which Kelly ran down the hill just to continue to stab. Kelly stated the last stab he did was right through my brother's throat, and stated something to the fact that the dude just wouldn't die, and said to Willie he was not leaving any witnesses behind. After the stabbing, Kelly untied the cords from my brother's wrist and said they could have fingerprints on them. One of them removed my brother's watch, but Kelly was the one who chose to wear at home. And while he was at home, he wore that watch. Kelly also said he wiped off the blood from the buck knife with his own jean jacket and threw the jacket and one of the knives out the window with all of Jerry's military uniforms and pictures. Kelly committed such a cruel, calculated, and premeditated murder. He received one charge for a total of three crimes. The kidnapping by abducting my brother at knife point, tying him up and confining him to the back of that van. Robbery by taking Jerry's van, money, and personal belongings from him, which Kelly drove the van the entire time when he had no driver's license. The first degree murder, stabbing my brother five or seven times, the intent to do harm, leaving my brother's body in the desert to decompose. Kelly slipped my brother's money, wore my brother's watch, handed out my brother's belongings to Willie, like the guitar Willie pawned, and the motorcycle to their youngest brother. These things were either sold for money or to be enjoyed. Kelly had no remorse for this victim during these crimes and after the crimes. He never stopped to seek help for my brother or to let him go. He never felt guilt or shame for what he did, because he wore my brother's watch, kept the victim's army jacket, possibly to ruin the future because he marked my brother's name off with a marker. What kind of person can wear his victim's personal belongings and think nothing of it? I believe Kelly. Kelly has only showed remorse for himself, for his own loss of losing his freedom. Some people just are not capable of feeling love and compassion for others. You don't hurt and kill people in order to gain for yourself, and that is exactly what Kelly did. My brother is dead, 20 years old. Kelly is the type of person who's going to do what he wants to do and will go to extreme measures. And when I say extreme measures, he's gone to extreme measures in the last 11 years of programs telling lies of all that took place and never coming true to what really happened. Remember, Kelly was 30 years old when he murdered my brother. Kelly was the one of those who got through the system. He was on a path of criminal destruction which escalated into murder. He had already been in and out of prison 3 times, escaped 2 times, probation once, and paroled twice. He was paroled and on probation when he left the state of North Carolina and ended up murdering my brother. He had a total of 3 felonies. I have documentation to what I just said. Kelly is a man that needs structure in his life. Kelly also has assaulted a police officer in the past. The officer said with a knife, but Kelly denied it. Kelly also has been charged with homicide, vehicle homicide in the past. And the person died because Kelly was behind the wheel of a car driving recklessly. Thus, Kelly also denies being reckless. Kelly had fathered 5 children with 2 different women and had never been court-ordered to pay child support for those children. He had no responsibility. These children grew up without a father because Kelly only cared about himself. I'm sure they were all so young when their father committed such a brutal crime. Kelly never appeared to be stable because he was using drugs and running from state to state. To what Kelly has done in prison to better himself, he has no more skills now than what he had when he went in with. The few classes he had taken, he only took towards the end of the 25 years, then he was taking tons of classes. It was all a show. He should have been taking self-help classes in the beginning, in the first years, 3 years of being incarcerated. I am sure he could have seeked something better. Now what my brother went through, Kelly put him through such mental and physical suffering, the extreme pain, which most of us have no idea what it's like being abducted at knife point, tied up and confined, and everything taken away in front of your face, to be physically controlled, the mental torment of not knowing if you're going to live or die, the mental trauma he felt as he was being walked out into the desert, his hands tied behind his back, keeping him from defending himself, the cruciating pain he felt from the first stab before he stopped breathing. This is so sad to live with. For the rest of my life, I will always have to fight back in my mind from seeing my brother die in my head. This did not go away, and now that I have to relive my brother's death every 6 months, it kills me inside. It hurts me. But I am my brother's keeper, and I have to defend his innocence and do what is right and true. I pray that someday there will be a law to stop these killings from being so often. It really keeps family members from closure. Please keep telling him, President, this crime was way too brutal to be released. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Neiman. Let me see if the board has any questions. Seeing if the board has no questions, then I'm going to go to the Maricopa County Attorney. If you want to just come up to the mic, state your name, and present the information.
Thank you, sir. There's a couple of things that I wanted to touch on as I listened to Mr. Hamilton speak this morning and then the victim next of kin speak. Mr. Hamilton indicated that he's only had 4 infractions in the Department of Corrections. You have his records. You know that he was found guilty of 9 different infractions. Only stopping in 2003, as Ms. Neiman pointed out, he realized that he was coming close to those 25 years and he needed to look good for you all in order to have any chance to get out. His programming also only escalated at that time. So the conforming of his behavior for the state is suspect, as in, is he doing it only to impress you all and get out, or has he truly changed? One of the other things that I thought of as I was listening to him speak, he told the police and he told the court system that he is the one who tied up this victim. He is the one who initiated the stabbing of this victim. Now he stands before you and says that it was his little brother and he didn't know what to do and he was just protecting his little brother. He protected his little brother so his brother could get a lesser sentence. So he lied to judges of the Superior Court of Arizona. He lied to the police, and this is if you believe that he's actually lying to them and not to you. He did that to get a benefit for his brother. Now he's telling you that it wasn't really him, it was his brother that did these things in order to get a benefit for himself. He has zero credibility. 3-time felon on probation and parole when he chooses to murder an innocent 20-year-old kid that had just gotten out of the Navy. The main thing that left for me to talk about, imagine, he gave these gentlemen a ride, or I shouldn't say gentlemen, he gave these individuals a ride from San Diego to El Centro. That's about 113 miles or so. He was going there to visit his dad. He told them they had to get out. That's when they took him and they tied him up. From that point, they drove to 20 miles east of Gila Bend. From El Centro to 20 miles east of Gila Bend is about 195 miles. 2 to 3 hour drive. As Jerome is sitting in the back, Jerry is sitting in the back, laying in the back, however they had him tied up, wondering what his fate was going to be. The mental anguish and torture. He had just gotten back from the Navy, 3 years gone from his family in Nebraska. His family, who takes the time to drive out here every 6 months and be here in order to support their innocent brother. He didn't come to this table with dirty hands. He didn't come to participate in a drug deal. He wasn't doing prostitution. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He gave these individuals a ride. He helped. He was a good Samaritan, and they took advantage of that. They tied him up, and they drove for miles and miles. Every mile that he continued to choose to drive. Kelly tells you today even that he was the one driving. Okay, I don't know why it matters that you have a driver's license, so you're the one driving. If you're going to be using drugs and murdering and robbing people, you know, don't drive without a license. But either way, he could have pulled over at any point and let Jerry out in the middle of the desert. They had miles and miles of space to get away before the police would have been called and caught. This person, Mr. Hamilton, was already given mercy in the fact that he got this plea. The leniency was given to him in the plea agreement in itself for not having to receive the death penalty. He does not deserve to get out. He has 3 children and 11 grandchildren that he can enjoy from the confines of the Arizona State Department of Corrections. Mr. Pitchy will never get those opportunities. He will never have children. He will never have grandchildren. His brother and his sister will never have nieces and nephews to enjoy from him, and at least Mr. Hamilton's family has those things. His crime merits him, and his behavior merits him staying where he's at, and we'd ask you to deny parole.
Okay. Do I have any questions?
Okay. I apologize.
No. You're doing it perfectly. Go ahead. Mr. Hamilton?
Yes, sir.
So we're coming up on the conclusion of your hearing. Is there anything else you'd like to present to the board at this time, sir?
No, sir. I just asked that the board think about the, like I said, I'm not trying to give no excuses or anything, but the person I was back then is not the person I am now. Look at my record in here for the last 37 years. I'm living in a community where there's more violence and more drugs than there is in any community on the street. And I've been living in here for 37 years with my record the way it is. I'm not the person I was back then. That man does no longer exist. And that's all I have to say.
Okay, well, Mr. Hamilton.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what I've done. I'm sorry for the pain. I'm sorry for everything. I can't change that now.
Mr. Hamilton, the board's going to go into discussion. So while the board's in discussion, we're going to ask you to remain on the phone, however, so I need you to remain silent while the board's in discussion. We will make a determination whether to revoke or reinstate you on your community supervision. However, we do want you to hear the discussion taken. Huh?
It's a parole hearing.
It is. So the board will make a decision whether to revoke, I'm saying revoke, whether to deny or grant you parole to your next consecutive sentence, absolute discharge, or a regular parole at this time, okay? So we'll get back to you. Stay on the line, sir. Board's now into discussion. We've actually had the opportunity to hear this case before. I do want to acknowledge that Mr. Hamilton has taken numerous classes and programming since he's been incarcerated. And, there is a letter that's inside the file, which he is asked if he had taken all the programs, in which he stated earlier that he has taken all the programs that's been allowed that he's able to take up until this time and this point, that he has taken those programs. And he did write a letter, but this was a letter that was in 2016 that was actually written. He got a response in December of 2016 in which he's taken all the programs basically that's allowable for him to take at the time. He said that he's only had four crimes. I think he has had four majors, which is a few, just very good for the amount of time that he's actually been incarcerated and inside the prison. He did take an Alford plea in the beginning, and I had to look up that Alford plea, which basically means that, you know, they're stating that they were innocent. However, they felt as though the attorneys had enough evidence to prove them guilty, and so he never did plead. That Alford plea is actually considered to be a guilty plea, but that's my understanding of what the exception of an Alford plea actually is. This was a very brutal and violent crime. We had the opportunity to also hear from the victims involved in this, and although I do see Mr. Kelly has taken numerous programs and been involved, I just don't really get the opportunity of the feeling that he has taken the full responsibility for the action, although he says that, but he doesn't. I'm just not getting that feeling that he's taking that full responsibility, with the exception, I think, that his release plan is very poor. And he has had some previous letters that would have halfway houses, in which he stated himself that in order to go to the halfway house, he would have to have, according to him, I believe he said $1,100 that he would have to have, and he doesn't have that funding in order to be able to do that. So based on all the information that we have in the report and the information that we have here at the hearing, I do not see Mr. Hamilton as being suitable to get a regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest at this time. That's my opinion. However, I am willing to listen to the rest of the colleagues, Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I want to follow up with that. Of course, this is the opinion of one voting board member, but I find Mr. Hamilton's narrative scripted and emotionless, and I think there's something to be said for the government's position on credibility, especially considering the shifting account of the innocent offense. Thank you, sir.
Okay, here no other comments coming from the board then. I am going to make a motion to deny absolute discharge, home arrest, or regular parole for Mr. Hamilton.
Agreed.
Okay. Motion by myself, I believe, second by Mr. Neal.
Yes.
Agree with Dr. Ryan. Agree, Mr. Quinones, and agree, Mr. Rittenhouse. This actually occurred in 1982, so it is not eligible for a one-year set-off. I'm going to mark the reasons for denial that it was a serious and violent offense, loss of human life. I'm going to mark it as a serious and deviant offense. I'm also going to mark trauma to the victim as that he was tied and transported for several hours in the actual crime itself. The mark that he violated previous probation. He had a history of prior criminal history, a history of assaultive behavior. I'm not going to mark poor institutional behavior because for the amount of time that he's actually been in there, he does have a good program. I'm not going to mark a lack of programming because he's taken several programs since he's been incarcerated. He does have a letter from DOC that he's taken all that he can. However, I'm going to mark a poor release plan because I'm not supportive of the release plan that he actually has. And I'm not going to mark no family community support. There are letters in the file that indicate that he has family community support. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Mr. Johnson, would you consider adding victim harassment because of the way that he or whoever committed the crime tied up the brother? I mean, the victim had to endure being driven and being tied and bound in the back and not knowing what was going to happen.
Certainly. Is there anything else the board would like to add or deny? Okay, Mr. Hamilton?
Yes.
Okay, so the board has voted to deny you absolute discharge of regular parole or home arrest. You will be certified by the Department of Corrections to come back before this board in about 6 months, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's going to conclude your hearing at this time, sir. Thank you for taking
Sir, can you make sure that I get a copy of the parole denial this time? I haven't been getting them.
So if you will work with your CO3 to work on getting a copy of that information, you should be able to receive that information, okay? All right. That's going to conclude your hearing at this time. Ms. Newman, thank you for being on the phone. We're going to disconnect at this time. And for all those who have taken the time and opportunity to appear, County Attorney, Family Support, thank you for taking the time to appear before this board. That's concluding the hearing at this time.